Welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. With this podcast, we want to give voices to many coastal scientists and engineers so we can meet them, at least virtually, and hear curious and less curious questions. My name is Ana Vila-Concejo, and today I am having a chat with Ross Ranasinghe, who, based in the Netherlands, holds the AXA Chair in Climate Change Impacts and Coastal Risk at the Department of Coastal and Urban Risk and Resilience, IHE Delft, and at the Department of Water Engineering and Management of the University of Twente. He's also a senior specialist in the Hydraulic Engineering Unit of Deltares in Delft. Ross is also a coordinating lead author for the IPCC, and I feel like I could keep on going, Ross, but I think we should start. So it is really, really great seeing you after many years. I'm really glad we finally worked out the time zones to make this happen. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. And it's really great to see you too after many years. I remember the time we used to work together on some Sydney beaches through ARC. So it's great to see you after many years.
So this podcast started a bit like a reaction to the isolation that we all felt and some are still feeling during the COVID lockdowns. And it looks like we are emerging at the other side of the pandemic. How are things for you? Do you feel that we are really emerging on the other side?
Yeah, it definitely feels like that here in the Netherlands. We are not wearing masks. All the restaurants are open. People are starting to shake hands again. So it's a good feeling, and the sun is coming out too. So great.
That's good. I hope you have a better summer than we did. It rained here like every day for I don't know how many weeks straight. It was heartbreaking. Okay, now to the podcast. So we have a set of semi-fixed questions to go through in about 30 minutes. So let's start. So the first question is, how did you start in coastal science?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. But I have a very specific answer for that. I did my bachelor's in Sri Lanka, where I was born and grew up. So I was studying civil engineering for my bachelor's, and it was really conventional civil engineering, a lot of things on designing trusses and highways and columns and slabs, and things like that. So we did 3 years of that, and everything ended up with guidelines. Like I still remember we used the BS8110, British Standards 8110, to design columns and slabs. So yeah, I mean, everything to me felt like there were prescriptions if you want to do anything, and it didn't leave a lot to imagination. In the final year, we had to do two honors courses, and I selected coastal engineering for one of them. And there, I remember students asked a lot of questions from the lecturer, and for a lot of those questions, the lecturer said, well, that is unknown, that is yet to be found. So I found that very interesting, that there was this little part of civil engineering to which there were a lot of unknowns. And then I got interested in that to at least try and answer some of those questions. So that's how I started in coastal engineering.
That's interesting. So you wanted the unknown. And may I ask, how did you end up then in Australia and then move the rest of your career? You are now in the Netherlands.
Yeah. Well, when I finished my bachelor's, because I wanted to know more, I didn't want to just be an engineer and work in the field. That must I and apply all these British codes to design things. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to study more. And so then I applied for various fellowships around the world, and I got a few of them. And that too, yeah, it's interesting. I think I talked to one of my lecturers back in Sri Lanka, a few of them, and several of them knew the Center for Water Research, and they really knew the director there was top notch, very well known, Professor Jörg Imberger. So they suggested, well, if you're interested in doing anything in the environmental field, that's where you should go at this point. So then I took that fellowship that I got from the University of Australia and moved to Perth. And there I did my PhD. Ended up not being with Jörg, but with Chari Patiarachi, who who promised me a project with a lot of field work all around the country and in other exotic places. So how could I say no to that?
So. I love that. So I started with field work and ended up modeling. Okay, that's probably another story.
Well, not really. Actually, the first 2 years of my PhD was entirely field work. And even for the latter part of my PhD, which involved making a model, which I made from scratch, the fieldwork was essential. I mean, the processes that I understood from the field required me to. I started my PhD thinking I will use models, but then I did a lot of fieldwork. Every 3 weeks, I remember, I used to drive down like 400 kilometers from Perth to Denmark, collect data over a summer period. And then when you kept analyzing the data, I found that, well, the models that were planning to use did not have the processes that were happening in the field. So then that's when I just thought I have to develop a new model. So yeah, it's hand in hand field work and modeling. So.
Fair enough. Okay, moving to the next question. What are your interests or hobbies? What do you like to do when you're not working?
Yeah, when I'm not working, it has not been too often, you know, in the last few years, especially because of IPCC, like doing full-time jobs. But yeah, when I do have time, I'm completely zoned out. Then I read very cheap thrillers or watch really shallow movies, you know, completely in a fantasy world. In my younger days, I also liked to play rugby and cricket on the weekend. But now, you know, cricket, I think I still can. But in the Netherlands, there's not much days that you can play cricket. If I were in Australia, I probably would go to the park and play some. But rugby is probably a bad idea at my age now.
Yes. In Australia, you used to be able to play cricket before the big rain started and lasted for 2 months. Okay, so the next question is about what you think you would like to change in our area of research to make it a better place.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I've been in this now for quite some years, I think more than 20 years. And yeah, I've seen the landscape changing, you know, in like the late 90s and early 2000s, I saw a lot of groups collaborating, working together in a nice, friendly way and trying to crack big problems. But in the last 10 years, I've started to see divergence, some silos, groups working on different things in a very protective way. And I don't feel that is very constructive. So I would like to encourage everyone to collaborate. Collaboration is a good thing, inclusion, rather than, you know, being competitive, collaborate. I think that's the way we can crack the big problems that are still before us. And as we all know, coastal zone is one of the, it is probably the most potentially highly impacted zone in the world due to climate change. So we have a lot of big problems to crack. And I think through effective collaboration, we can harness the strengths of different groups, different individuals, and make bigger steps than we can make individually or internally within our own groups. So that's what I would like to see change.
I think it's a good point. And I'm about to ask you a question that I didn't warn you that I would ask you, but I just thought about it. So feel free to say no. But do you think that during COVID, when we haven't been allowed to travel, we have had a lot more Zooms, and the possibility of having in the room, really not in the room, but in Zoom, someone from the other side of the world has suddenly opened. Do you think that somehow COVID has allowed better collaboration or less collaboration?
I think the former. I think, yeah, before COVID, we hardly had these kind of Zoom meetings and, you know, conference calls. For some things we did, for like UN things, we were always doing those things. For IPCC, we were always doing these things. But when COVID happened, everyone, like what you're doing now with coast to coast. And so, yeah, I mean, even when you think about individual research projects that I have been involved in over these last 2 or 3 years, there have been some occasions where some collaborations or some papers could not have happened without this kind of conference calls. So yeah, I think COVID made these conference calls very normal thing, even for schools, you know, for anyone. Even. So I think the world has actually become a much smaller place and it allows more collaboration.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear. Okay, moving on with the questions. The next one is about supervision. Do you have a particular approach to supervision or any tips that you want to share with us?
Well, I haven't learned supervision, how to supervise in a course or anything. What I do usually is I like to start, I suppose you're asking about PhD supervision, right? That level.
Yes, yes, mostly. PhD or master's, you know, high degree research supervision.
Oh, yeah. Well, I talk about PhD supervision because at master's, I supervise mostly at IT Delft and we have a very 6-month period. So, you know, it's a different style of supervision. But for PhD supervision, I like to start any project with a very clear definition of the project. What is expected, what are the deliverables I expect, and what are the outputs, so that the student is clear when they start. Some students like to follow that exactly, and that is okay with me. But what I like is when a student takes that what I give at the beginning as a starting point and takes it further. You know, like I like to, in the last couple of years of PhD, I would like to learn from the student. Student should know more than me about what he or she is doing, develop new things. So I also allow a lot of flexibility and freedom to go beyond the framework that is provided at the beginning. That I guess that would be my style. And I always involve people from within the organization and outside the organization. You know, for certain chapters, there could be different experts that could contribute. Mm-hmm. So then I pull in people. For a recent PhD, I pulled in people like Brad Murray and Patrick Barnard, sometimes Magnus Larsen, who was my PhD examiner. So yeah, whoever is needed, I will contact them and ask them to contribute. And if they're happy, then I put them together and we get a nice result in the end.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I always say to my students too that if they are not arguing with me in their last year, just explaining things to me and teaching me what they're learning, then their PhD is probably not going that well. So yes, I completely agree with you. Okay, the next question. Can you tell us about your favorite paper or a paper that changed your life, your career direction?
Yeah. Well, there's so many nice papers I have read. But I think two that really come to my mind, stick in my mind, top two papers I have read, I think they changed the way I thought. Because before I came to these papers, I was really, like you mentioned earlier, a modeler. I made a model and I tried to solve things by process-based models. And then when I was doing my postdoc with Graham Simons and Rob Holman, which was on Argus video cameras that was being introduced at that time in Australia, I read this paper called Bars, Bumps and Holes, which was published in 1982 in JGR by Rob Holman and Tony Bowen. That's a paper, I think, for the very first time kind of put forward the idea that nearshore morphology is there's some self-organization happening there. It's not completely chaotic, it's not completely regular, but based on the forcing and also the prevailing morphological features, there are self-organizing patterns at certain length scales and time scales. I know Giovanni Coco has done a lot on these things with his linear stability models. So that's one paper that really stuck in my mind. Great paper. And the other paper, which I studied rip currents for 4 or 5 years of my career. I still teach about rip currents in my lectures. And there I found this great paper by Tony Bowen again in JGR 1969 called Rip Currents, part one, theoretical investigations that laid down the foundation on how the radiation stresses generate the nearshore rip currents. So for me, those are the top two papers I have ever read.
Cool, thank you for sharing. So now the next question, and that's a question that is hard for academics to do, but the question is, can you briefly explain one of your topics of research to our listeners?
Briefly explain one of my topics, okay. Well, that's hard to do in a couple of minutes, but as I said, I started off with process-based modeling, you know, like, so I thought models that work at small time steps, and then you do a lot of time steps, and then you do a simulation for a year or two. And then in the mid-2000s, when I was working for the Australian government, there was a lot of interest on climate change impacts. And yeah, it was clear that these models could not be used in a continuous way, at least to see how climate change would affect those. So then I started on this thing also with people like Dave Callahan, the University of Queensland. It was really the start for my focus on reduced complexity modeling. So we don't strip down a process model, but we think, okay, what are the main physics that are responsible for a certain process, like let's say dune erosion or shoreline change or inlet dynamics, some specific problem. So process-based model would give you idea of what happens in the entire zone, right? Cross-shore, long-shore, inlet dynamics, everything. But a reduced complexity model targets one thing. And then we think, okay, what are the main physics that go into this? And then we represent those physics in a simple equation that doesn't involve time stepping or implicit solutions. So that can be solved very fast. And then there's also the uncertainty associated with climate. We know there are different scenarios, different models give different projections. It's important to incorporate those in the results that you get. So then you have to run these models thousands of times. So I think that is the thing I have been trying to do since the mid-2000s, reduced complexity modeling, probabilistic reduced complexity modeling of climate change impacts on coals. We have now developed a few models that are also, that have got traction, and people outside of my group are also using them, which is nice to see. So we have the probabilistic coastline decision model that's applied in about 10 countries at the moment, also for projects like Asian Development Bank projects, World Bank projects. Governments are making decisions using these model results to define setback lines, or what we call economically optimal setback line, because we also go a step further from the hazard. So then when we have probabilistic results, we can also use that together with, for example, property value data to develop risk maps. And then we can come up with economically optimal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm developing. That's the thing I have been trying to do, is to develop these different models to be able to predict or project how different coastal types, coastal environments might respond to climate change. In a nutshell, that's it.
Okay, so the next question is, what is the strangest thing that you have seen at the coast?
Yeah, that's, well, maybe not so strange for some people, but I was doing a project in the east coast of Sri Lanka, and in one location I saw a ship had run aground, fairly big ship, and then a tombolo had developed from the coastline and connected with the ship. So that became a tourist attraction. People could walk on the tombolo, this ship, and for me, yeah, that was fascinating, because that's I've also done some work on submerged breakwaters and emergent breakwaters with people like Ian Turner when I was back in Australia. So there, one of the things was that, you know, certain, if you place a submerged breakwater or emergent breakwater some distance from the shoreline, you get salient. If you build it closer, you get tombolo. Those kind of things we discovered in the lab and also in models. So then I see this happening naturally in the field when a ship run aground. So that was quite cool to me, maybe because of my experience in breakwaters.
So, going back to science, do you think we can predict long-term morphodynamic changes beyond the Kegel scales?
We can, using those reduced complexity models that I mentioned. We have the ability to do that. But if you mean by morphological changes, you know, what happens in the entire coastal zone in a very connected, you know, crush-show processes, long-show processes, and tidal inlets, fluvial sediment supply, all those things. Like a model like DEL-3D or MIC-21. Yeah, I haven't seen such a 50 or 100 year simulation yet that produces reasonable results. The longest simulation I have seen is a 30 year simulation of sand engine by Iron Line Deck. That looked nice, nice and smooth. But I know a lot of effort went into it. The cluster at Delta S was completely dominated by those simulations. So it does take time. But now I think if you want to look at above the decadal scale, we have to use different tools like radial complexity models or ESM type models, some kind of hybrid models that connect machine learning with models. So I think we have to find different ways to go beyond, you know, 10, 20, 30 years.
Now, it's a little bit related of what you're speaking about. Can you think of a major advance in coastal science that would happen in the next 50 years? Or you could use this question also to say something that you really, really want to see happening.
Yeah, well, I think a big problem for us coastal engineers, coastal modelers, is the lack of data, right? So for model validation, for model initialization, even at local scale. Now we have, I think, a lot of wave data available from products like ERA. Tide data is also available, but morphological data is really lacking in many places. And I see that already starting to change with the emergence of Earth observations with new satellites like Sentinel-2 and with very frequent revisit times. I think now we're down to like 1 week revisit times. I think eventually, well, not too far, I think, because I see also the advances being made in this field are very rapid. So we would see Earth observations being used to get very frequent updates on morphology, waves, currents, things like that, at least a weekly time scale all over the world with a fairly high vertical accuracy. At the moment, there are problems with vertical accuracy, but people are working hard on fixing these issues. So I think in the next 10 to 20 years, using Earth observations, you know, it'll be nice if you have any project location, we could just go to a site, draw a box around the location we are investigating and get all the data that's available. Just click download morphology, waves, tides, whatever. That would be a nice development. And I think we'll get there. And another thing is also I see happening in that time scale because also of the renewed interest in climate change impacts. Clickable, zoomable products that give us all the projections of coastal hazards like coastal flooding, coastal erosion, all over the world. I mean, they will probably not be accurate at the local scale, but they will probably give you an idea of, you know, where certain hazards will be high or low, where do you need to pay attention, and then maybe you can do a more detailed study using a more high resolution model, for example. But to have this kind of products that are clickable, zoomable, and downloadable of hazards, impacts, and risk even, if we can get that far, that would be really cool. Very useful, I think, for decision-making and prioritizing areas of study. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of things I would like to see.
Those are very cool things that should happen. Okay, and the next question is about your other contributions to society. What do you do outside work?
Outside work, well, I would read this as you asking me, how do I support society through my professional knowledge? Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not I don't do any like completely non-professional volunteering work or anything like that. But yeah, through my profession, so as you know, so outside of my job, I contribute to United Nations process like IPCC and World Ocean Assessment. These are not part of my job. I volunteer for these things and or get asked to do those things. And outreach is also a very important thing, I think, at the school level, especially with the findings that coastal zone will be seriously at risk from climate change. So we have, with some support from AXA Insurance, we have developed some outreach products targeted at high school level or the beginning undergraduate level that describe how, you know, like most people think what will happen in the coast, sea level rise and then flooding. There it stops. Right? That's what most people think. But there's many different ways that climate change can affect our coastal zone. So in a booklet that we have made with very simple graphics, which we have actually, we got professional help to do that because as scientists, we can't make simple graphics too much detail. So we got some help from graphic artists and we made some schematics figures that show at least what are the first order climate change impacts on coasts. We were trying to release that book and then COVID hit. So I thought then the world has other priorities. So we did not release that, but I think we will release that. So that's that kind of outreach also we try to do.
That sounds fantastic. Okay, the next question. What was the best advice that you ever received?
The best advice, I think that also, yeah, that helps me in my career too, but this was advice I got when I was in high school from one of my teachers, was to, well, I still remember his exact words was, don't just criticize things, fix it. So I try to follow that advice. You know, sometimes in science, I see some problematic things. Some papers that have, or some studies that, in my opinion, has some weak spots. So, yeah, I don't engage in criticizing those things. Even if I review such paper, I would try to be constructive. I try not to criticize things in papers without telling the authors how they can fix it, improve it. I find that, not very useful, right? To just say, oh, this is wrong. Without, if I can't suggest a way to solve it, then I don't see a point in me criticizing. I should be able to fix it or at least guide people towards fixing. So then if I also see some gaps in papers or some things that I think have not been addressed properly, then I immediately go into my framework. Oh, how can I do this better? And that has been the origin of many of my research projects. Many of the papers I have written are efforts to improve things that I saw as lacking. So yeah, that is the best advice, I think. So don't just criticize things, fix it.
I like that advice. I think we should all take it. Okay, Roche, before going to our final quick questions, is there something that you would like to say that you haven't had a chance?
Yeah, for the younger generation, I would like to say something to the emerging coastal engineers and coastal scientists. I see, you know, in the various requests I get for reviews and being on editorial boards and such, I see a huge tendency to try to publish papers in these high impact journals like Nature and Science. And that's good. It's always good to try. You know, there's an Australian saying that says, got to be in it to win it. So it's good. It's good to try. But I think at some level, it's also unhealthy to be completely driven by that. You know, like if you do good science, if you publish them in reasonable journals, the big papers will come. So, and I think in fact that the details, solid papers with a lot of information that is useful can only really be published in subject-specific journals. Like you asked me, what are the two papers that I like most? They are both JGR papers. So in those high-impact journals, they do serve a purpose. And they get the message out fast, but they also tend to be a little bit sensationalized. So, what I would like to say to the younger generation is to do the science good and thoroughly. Don't focus too much on making big impact right at the beginning. That will just come, you know, when you do good work.
Wise words, Rosh. Okay, so now we have our final quick questions, just to wrap up. Don't think too much. Just give me the first answer that comes to your head. So, favorite band, music, or composer?
Yeah, well, there's only one answer to that. It might be quite unexpected to some of my colleagues or most of my colleagues, but my favorite musician is Michael Jackson. I grew up in the 80s, I'm sorry.
Definitely unexpected. Favorite dish or signature dish?
Anything from Thailand. I love Thai food.
The latest book you have read?
Okay, as I said, I read cheap thrillers, and I have this favorite author called John Sanford. He writes crime novels. So I think the latest one I read from him was Eyes of Prey. Read it all night to finish it. So.
Cool. Favorite movie?
Favorite movie, yes, that's also undisputed for me. I think it's the only movie that Al Pacino and Robert De Niro sit face to face. It's Heat. Movie is Heat.
Okay. Coffee or tea?
Coffee, sure.
Okay, so thank you very much, Rosh, for agreeing to be interviewed for Coast to Cast. It has been really good having you here. And also thank you to our listeners for following us in one more episode of Coast to Cast. I hope you have enjoyed it, and see you next time.